supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I've just come away from a really fascinating experience this weekend, during which I had a psychotherapy session with the dark and twisted character Iago from Shakespeare's play Othello, the latest production of the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater. We'll play an excerpt from my interview with Iago a little later in the show. You know, I've always been interested in what we call evil. I think it stems from when I was in middle school. I had a seventh grade teacher who I loved, who many of the kids loved, who did evil things to me and other kids. He was also a good guy who did wonderful things. I now belong to a synagogue where the rabbi, before I joined, is currently in prison for having had his wife killed. Yet, at the same time, he created a synagogue that's one of the warmest, wealthiest emotionally and spiritually, one of the most vibrant, kindest, compassionate synagogues that I've been exposed to my whole life, and he helped create it. So I've always had an interest in evil. In India, many of you have heard the name Namaste, which roughly translated means, I bow to the God within you. It's a philosophy that everyone has a piece of the divine within. In the Bibles and stories about the Old Testament, there are sparks of divine light in all of us. But is there all of us? I've done a good deal of research in preparation for this show, and some people are wired in ways that they're really not capable of feeling love or compassion, guilt or remorse. They're called psychopaths. On today's show, we'll explore the meaning of psychopathy with several guests. They'll help us identify personality traits and behaviors, understand the nature of predatory relationships, discuss underlying causes, and look at the debate in the mental health community. Can psychopaths be treated, or even should they? We begin the show with William Herstein and Sandra Brown. Bill Herstein's a philosopher and a scientist. He's published scientific articles on consciousness and sociopathy. He's written several books, including Mind Melding, Consciousness, Neuroscience, and the Mind's Privacy. He joins us from New Mexico. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Sandra Brown is the publisher, is the founder of the Institute for Relational Harm Reduction and Public Pathology Education. She writes for Psychology Today, and her books include Women Who Love Psychopaths and Counseling Victims of Violence. Sandra, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Later on, we're going to talk about treatment with a clinician who works with some of the most violent juveniles in the country. Bill, let's start with you. You get to psychopaths by studying something called confabulation. Now, this is a unique symptom of people who have brain damage secondary to alcoholism, where they actually fill in the gap with something they've made up. But with confabulation, they believe what they're saying. They don't know, actually, that they're making something up. So how does this lead you to psychopaths?
Well, the idea is that the confabulator is somebody whose speech is not very valuable, even though he's very confident in it. I use a broader definition of confabulation than just memory errors. It's somebody who tends to say false things that they actually believe. And so we start to shade into the sociopath who starts to believe his own line of bull, for instance. They're infamous for using words in a very insincere and highly instrumental way. So I think there's sort of a continuum between them and the clinical confabulators.
Huh. Sandra, I want to, you know, we talked to Bill about how he came to the field. You come to the field in a from a completely different direction. You were kind of thrust into the field when you were pretty young, age 20.
I was in my mid to late 20s when my father was murdered by someone I believe was psychopathic. And out of an interest in understanding the disorder of no conscience, how people come to, you know, take someone's life, I began to study psychopathy and went back to school to become a therapist.
Can I ask you, if you don't mind, about the circumstances around your father's murder? Why you believed this man was a psychopath?
Well, he had a pretty long history, even prior to my father's murder, of a lot of antisocial kind of violence. Shortly after he murdered him and was put in prison, they moved him to one of the hospitals for the criminally insane. So he was, you know, evidently there was an event in prison as well. So they moved him to that facility. He was there for a while before he was attempted to be brought back to the regular prison.
So what impact did all of that have on you?
I'm sorry?
What impact, what happened to you when your father was murdered? You were, you know, a very young woman.
Well, I actually got post-traumatic stress disorder from that impact. I was taken to the scene before it was cleaned up and saw, you know, his blood splattered everywhere, his handprints embedded in his own blood. It was, you know, a horrific impact that took many years to work through to even to get to the point of interest in the field. So I think that a homicide like that is something that you always carry that impact. It's not something you get over.
Yeah, we've got a local psychotherapist here in Philadelphia named Kathleen O'Hara, and her son was brutally murdered when he was away at college, and that's the population she treats. She, you know, whose family members were killed by violent death, and you know that's her area of expertise. It's sure different than any other kind of trauma. I want to get to your book, as I'm sure you do. There's an awful lot of science in your book, and one of the things you talked about was that the limbic region is not as active with psychopaths as it is with the normal population. That's where we find the fight or flight response. So what are the implications of that?
Well, I mean, you know, part of the whole clinical picture about psychopathy is this reduced empathy, conscience. They have low fear and high callousness. And so I think that is the piece of the danger with them, is that impacted limbic system. Even with the element of reading fear on people's faces, this is, I think, sort of the issue that we've tried to bring up within psychopathic batterers versus non-psychopathic batterers, that when you have someone whose brain regions are impacted like that, when there is an assault in non-psychopathic batterers, when someone is cringing or, you know, crying or putting their hands up to not be struck, that image, you know, relates to their ability to feel empathy and also read that fear signal in whoever they're harming. And the inability to do that is where the risk level in their violence, I think, is so high for other people.
Bill, where does moral reasoning come into play here?
Yeah, I think one message here is that our normal moral reasoning is writ through and through with emotions. We need emotions to guide our moral reasoning. Without that, it all becomes very abstract. I think the psychopath, when he's hurting somebody, can tell that that person is feeling fear, and can tell that the person doesn't like it. The problem is they just don't care a whit about it, or they're actually encouraged by what they're seeing in the person, which is why you should never appeal to their mercy, you know, because they really don't have any.
I want to ask you both a question, and I want to tell our listeners and you, Bill, we don't have the greatest cell quality on your phone in the world.
Okay.
We should say you're on a cell phone in probably in a magnificent area. And I think what we're hearing is some wind in the background, if that's possible. But I want to ask you both a question here, and we'll start with you, Sandra. Are people born psychopaths, or do they become one, or both? Many, many years ago, I was supervising a doctoral student who was writing a dissertation on the theory of primary psychopathy and what he called at the time neurotic psychopaths, the people who acted in ways that looked evil, but underneath it they were trying to resolve a conflict or fill in something inside that was empty. So, Sandra, what are your thoughts? Are people born psychopaths, or do they learn to be one?
Well, the way we approach it in working with, you know, people coming out of these pathological love relationships is we sort of have an umbrella of low empathy disorders that impact others. And a lot of times, you know, people lump together those low conscience disorders of narcissism, antisocial, sociopath, and psychopath. And a lot of people, you know, confuse those and put those together or do it on purpose like we do when we are just talking about the whole issue of low empathy spectrum and low conscience disorders. But actually, you know, the psychopath and the sociopath are technically different. And now that there is much more neuroscience research going on into the psychopath's brain through MRIs and looking at that, we do and can see that the psychopath is structurally and genetically often very different than some of the other low conscience disorders.
Bill,
they usually go, the psychopath, you know, is born that way, where sociopaths are often created that way from environment, whether it's abuse and neglect. I don't know for the average person being harmed by someone with low conscience whether or not that matters to them as much as, of course, what has happened to them.
Bill, I want to weigh in, like to hear you weigh in. Do you agree, Sandra is saying that basically psychopaths are born that way. They're born with that wiring. Do you agree?
I think so, yeah. One of the gold standards here is twin studies, given that twin A has psychopathy, what are the odds that twin B has it? And given that whether the twins are dizygotic or monozygotic, they show increasing rates, and sure enough, they do. That's a very scary thing. As a philosopher, it reminds me of the old question about, you know, are humans innately good or bad, right? They used to think, well, the question doesn't really make sense because we are the ones who devise the concepts of good and bad, so of course we're a little bit good and a little bit bad at the extremes. But what this seems to indicate is that there's a bad streak in our DNA. There's a type of person who lives off of other people. The notion of a predator, right, I think is a useful notion here. And the natural world is full of beings like this. It's not surprising that we would find it in our species.
Yeah, and I do want to mention, first of all, narcissists are not necessarily psychopaths. I hear a lot of complaints from people, mostly women, that their husbands are psychopaths because they're so self-absorbed and they ignore other people's feelings. But that's not a psychopath. That's a narcissist. And, you know, narcissists don't usually do evil things. But the other thing I wanted to mention, and just I'd like you, Sandra, to comment on this just quickly before our break. It is on a continuum here. You talk about low empathy disorders. You know, right away, when you say low empathy, we're talking on a continuum from people who have, like, hearts made of concrete all the way up to empaths who, you know, just feel deeply everything. So, you know, we it's not, I mean, there's a certain point where it's us and them, but, you know, we all have threads of lack of empathy inside. So let's reintroduce you, who we are and what we're talking about. We're talking about psychopaths, what it really means, who they really are, and what it's not. And, you know, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk when we come back with Sandra about women who are attracted to psychopaths. Sandra's the founder of the Institute for Relational Harm Reduction and Public Pathology Education, and her books include Women Who Love Psychopaths and Counseling Victims of Violence. We're also talking with Bill Herstein. He's a philosopher and scientist, and his books include Brain Fiction, Self-Deception, and The Riddle of Confabulation. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Guardian Nurses Healthcare Advocates supports WHYY. Serving the region for 10 years, these registered nurses accompany individuals to doctors, help get second opinions, and help with insurance claims. GuardianNurses.com. Guardian Nurses, lighting your way through the healthcare maze.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. You can receive tax deductions for sustaining nonprofits across southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation works with financial advisors and administers donor-advised funds, charitable gift annuities, memorials, and scholarships. The Foundation takes care of all the details, making it easy for you to make a difference forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance supports WHYY. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance is offering information on how to protect kids at pa-fsa.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about psychopaths, who they are, really, and really who they're not. And we're also going to be talking about who's attracted to psychopaths in these relationships, because they're not all in prison. My guests are William Herstein, a philosopher and scientist, Sandra Brown, who's a psychotherapist who writes extensively about women who are attracted to psychopaths. Sandra, I read that over 25% of the people in prison are psychopaths. But what about the general population? I've read that between 1 and 4% in the general population are psychopaths. Where are they and what are they up to?
They're your neighbors. They might be a family member. They're everywhere. I mean, 1 to 4% of the population, of course, it is a guesstimate for white-collar psychopathy. These are the people that, you know, fly under the radar of detection, and the best numbers we have about psychopathy are in the criminal population once they are, you know, incarcerated. But since a lot of the white-collar guys and women are not, may fall right under the criminal behavior lessons, we don't know. Dr. Martha Stout, in her book, The Sociopath Next Door, said, you know, 1 in 25 people have no conscience. And it's depending on, you know, where you are going to do the cutoff on what constitutes psychopathy in terms of conscience. But they are certainly out there, and I think that the interest in white-collar psychopathy, especially the increase in events like Bernie Madoff and things like that, have increased the interest in white-collar psychopathy. So,
so where you said
because a lot of times these guys are not incarcerated.
You know, you mentioned Bernie Madoff. I wonder, and Bill, if you can weigh in on this. So if they're not in prison, Sandra mentioned white-collar psychopaths, so what are they doing for a living?
Yeah, I think they've managed to build up a set of skills that allows them to avoid getting arrested. The literature makes a distinction between successful and unsuccessful psychopaths. It's a very rough cut because all it means is the unsuccessful ones have been apprehended. But sure, yeah, I think part of how they do that, they memorize a list of rules. Since they can't trust their gut instinct, they can't trust their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
They develop a sort of a rule-based, quote, conscience. It's not a real conscience, but they do have certain rules they try to abide by.
Sandra, psychopaths are predominantly men, and from what I can read, we don't know why. Any guesses? And what does psychopathy look like in a man versus a woman?
I don't think psychopathy is primarily men. I think we have a gender bias against female psychopaths. I think they're underdiagnosed. I think they're often diagnosed as borderline. Having run one of the largest borderline clinics in the state of Florida, my windshields were shot out, my brake lines were cut, I was stalked, assaulted, by female borderlines that I think were, grossly underdiagnosed. So I think that there are a lot more female psychopaths than what actually end up getting diagnosed.
I'm confused here about something, because you talk about women who do these things that look impulsive. My vision of a psychopath is that of premeditated. And, you know, when I hear about these impulsive behaviors, maybe I'm attributing something you didn't say, but when I hear impulsive behaviors, I'm not seeing diminished emotions. I'm seeing just the opposite, out of control emotions.
Mm-hmm. Well, psychopaths are associated with high levels of impulsivity, especially the incarcerated guys. That's how they end up there. White-collar guys have learned a little bit about how to toe the line within what they're doing, but the impulsivity is one of the areas. For instance, in the PCLR, which is one of the testing instruments for psychopathy that they actually look for and test.
I want to say to Bill, unfortunately, we have tried and we just don't have a good connection. So we're going to have to say goodbye to you with great regret and thanks for what you have contributed and what you do contribute to the field. So thank you for...
All right, good talking to you.
You too,
bye-bye.
Bill. Bill's a philosopher and a scientist. He's written about consciousness and sociopathy, and his books include Brain Fiction, Deception, and The Riddle of Confabulation. You can learn much more about Bill and his work on our website, whyy.org/voices. Sandra, psychopaths are manipulative, and their agenda is often hidden. But isn't that true of many of our interactions, and maybe most? You know, I serve on the board of trustees for the Boys and Girls Club of Camden, New Jersey. So it's not unusual for me to ask someone out to lunch, make small talk, and then ask them for money for the club. You know, I mean, that's manipulative for people to write to me and make a pitch for the show. So is this a variation of a theme, or is this quantitatively different?
Right. As you were talking about before, about looking at things on a continuum, that is also how psychopathy, you know, is viewed. Yes, everybody has levels of manipulative behavior. We don't always tell the truth. But where is that cutoff? Where is not telling the truth sometimes the cutoff to pathological lying, which is associated with psychopathy? But I think the biggest measurement for psychopathy has to do with what Dr. Robert Hare pinpointed in those disorders, which has to do with levels of callousness. And that reduced level of empathy and conscience. So that's really where you start seeing and looking for the psychopathy.
I want to talk about the area of this that I know interests you most. One of the hallmark characteristics of psychopaths are charm, manipulation. I can see where some women would be at risk for being romanced by a psychopath. Yes?
Yes, absolutely. We were the first ones to really spend an effort on researching women who had been in relationships with psychopaths. We had started out by working with women coming out of relationships with people who had a cluster B personality disorder. And it was on the lower end of the continuum in the beginning, people coming out of relationships with borderlines and narcissists. And when we started getting women coming out of relationships with psychopaths, noticing the similarities of not only the relationship dynamic, but her personality traits, and began to look for research about these women and could not find any. I was starting to write the book, Women Who Love Psychopaths, and couldn't find any research. So we stopped in the middle of the book and did the research to find out what is it about the psychopath's charm, the luring that he does, the intensity of attraction that seems to be mutual, magnetic almost, and found some, you know, fascinating information about the temperament traits of women who are attracted to and tolerant of some of the most dangerous people on the planet. And these very highly elevated temperament traits of, ironically, everything he doesn't have, empathy, tolerance, a lot of 30-some traits that were significantly elevated up into the 80 and 97 percentiles.
So, Sandra, you, in your book, you talk about hyper-empathy or too much empathy in these women. What's the difference between what you're calling too much empathy and what we used to call codependency or enabling? Are they different labels for the same kind of character trait?
Well, I think that they are not. I adhere to the old concepts about codependency that are addiction-based. I mean, codependency used to be, you know, connected to the co-partner of an addict. Some of these psychopaths are not addicts, nor is she an addict, which really, you know, made us stop and research again, because when you don't have that level of, you know, addiction going on, then what could it be? And so it sort of coincided with a lot of the neuroscience that is coming out on hyper-empathy. That's a really hot topic right now that it is being researched about hyper-empathy. And what we're finding is very often it is not related to the addiction model of codependency, that there is something else going on in her elevated levels of empathy other than codependency.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, Sandra, and we're going to come back and speak with Michael Caldwell, who works at the Mendota Mental Health Institute, and he actually works with violent offenders in Wisconsin, people who might rightly carry the label psychopath. So let's come back after a short break. We've been talking about psychopaths, people who relate to them, who they are, and where they are. When we come back, we're going to talk about whether they are treatable, and if so, what's the prognosis? I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Penn Program for Mindfulness will sponsor two mindfulness meditation events on May 10th and 11th, exploring mindfulness and meditation as powerful tools for personal growth and transformation. Events will include a Friday evening lecture by Sharon Salzberg about mindfulness meditation and a half-day workshop on meditation as a tool for compassion. For information on all programs offered, online at pennmedicine.org/mindfulness or 215-615-2775.
Dr. Samson Davis grew up on the tough streets of Newark, New Jersey, but in his new book he says med school wasn't a ticket out of town, but a way to come back and help out, and he hopes he can inspire others to follow his lead. Living and Dying in Brick City, that's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about psychopaths with Michael Caldwell, and we've been talking with Sandra Brown, who writes for Psychology Today and has written Women Who Love Psychopaths. But I'm also joined by Michael Caldwell. Michael's a senior staff psychologist at Mendota Mental Health Institute for Serious and Violent Juvenile Offenders in Wisconsin. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Michael, I want to read something to you from Scientific American. In an article there, Professor Scott Lilienfeld suggests that psychopathy may be treatable He says, although psychopaths are often unmotivated to seek treatment, research suggests that psychopaths may benefit as much as non-psychopaths from psychological treatment, even if their core personality traits are exceedingly difficult to change. Do you agree?
I agree by and large, yeah. I think that the idea that psychopaths are completely untreatable, or even that they may be made worse by treatment, there just isn't very good scientific evidence to support that. And in particular, the program that I work with, when we work with kids that are in the juvenile system, and so the average age is about 15 years of age, it's like any disorder. I think if you can intervene earlier in the process, you have a better chance of shifting some of those personality characteristics and preventing the person from functioning as a psychopath once they reach adulthood.
Sandra, I know this talk about treatment and hope in treatment may worry you, as it may give women in these relationships hope that their spouse could change, which is, would imagine, is a potentially dangerous thing to hope for.
Well, I think, as he pointed out, that the earlier the intervention in psychopathy, the more you may have the ability to work on some of those problem areas. We deal with adult women who are coming out of these relationships, usually after years. And as we mentioned in the last segment, that have some very elevated temperament traits themselves, including these traits of really high empathy, high tolerance, and really high hope. And those put together with an untreated psychopath who's now 30 or 40 years old, it is inevitable harm. The thing we do know about psychopaths is they are often, unmotivated for treatment, and can go, rounds and rounds and rounds, especially in a marriage of, okay, I'll go. And, they go for a couple sessions, and then they're back out and out of treatment. And so our approach is that because the treatment outcomes are low based on their motivation, and I believe some of the hardwiring of the neuroscience we're now learning about the brain, we do not encourage the women to wait through rounds of treatment, especially if there has been high levels of violence. One of our counselors is on her local fatality review committee in her own county, and knowing what we know about who does that in terms of those levels of violence, we don't encourage that.
So let's switch generations now to Michael, and I want to talk about the Mental Health Institute there in Madison. So tell us about the boys you work with. Tell us what they've done to get there and a little bit about who they are.
Okay, yeah. I would just, before I touch on that, I would just mm-hmm. want to say I couldn't agree more with what I just heard. A lot of times what family members and spouses do to try to help the person change is exactly the opposite of what will produce a change. It just feeds into the psychopath's manipulation. So the boys that we've worked with, though, have been through the correction system usually for many years. The average age of first arrest is about age 11. The typical kid has had six or seven felony adjudications before they come to us. About a little less than half have either hospitalized or killed a victim at some point.
Would you consider these kids psychopaths?
I wouldn't, because for two reasons. One is that when you have, say, a 15-year-old boy who has done a lot of these violent crimes and is very cold-blooded and manipulative and deceitful and all of those things, I don't think that you can assume that those characteristics are crystallized. That we know from the neuroscience and a lot of other things that there's a lot of change that happens during adolescence and into even the first few years of the 20s. I think it's a mistake to label a kid as a psychopath, even if he shows all of those characteristics that we kind of attribute to a prototypical psychopath, because there is just much more potential for change at that age level. So they're sometimes talked about as budding psychopaths, but we don't use that label in our program.
What does your facility look like physically?
It looks really just like a prison type facility. We have, you know, steel doors, and the rooms are single rooms, so the boys don't share a room with anyone. They're at the beginning of their stay with us, it's a very spare room, because these are kids who have been in the juvenile training schools, essentially the juvenile version of a prison, and they were so aggressive and disruptive in that setting that they're among the 10% that are taken out of that setting and sent to our program. So these are the worst of the worst in the system. And so it's a pretty spare looking facility when we start out. And then as the kid makes progress, then they're allowed to have more things in their room, more decorations and books and things of that nature.
What does progress look like? How do you define progress?
Well, we have a couple ways. One is that we do a series of tests on admission when the kid first comes in. And we repeat those tests every 90 days. And those have to do with measures of impulsivity, callousness, narcissistic tendencies, criminal attitudes, and a whole range of things, anger control and so on. Then we also rate their behavior on up to 10 scales a day. And we have all that go into a computer so that we can track with a graph their improvement on any given area of their life, whether it's their interaction with peers or ability to follow rules or whatever, and so we can keep track of progress that way too, of just behavioral control and interpersonal improvement in their interpersonal functioning and so on.
I am curious about the philosophy of the program, the assumptions you make about these kids when they come in. So is your intervention trauma-based? Like, do you assume trauma in their background, or is it more hardline and treat them like personality disorders, more simply reward and punishment kind of thing?
It's really neither one. We offer the kids, obviously there's quite a bit of clinical services available, much more than in a typical juvenile correction setting. So in a typical day, a kid will have some time with a psychiatrist, with a psychologist, with a social worker, and probably with maybe a speech therapist or recreation therapist and some other folks. So quite a bit of treatment. We don't have the program organized around trauma, so there isn't an assumption of trauma, but most of the kids have had traumatic histories, so we work a lot with that. But we don't assume that, you know, if we can resolve those traumatic background, those traumatic experiences, that's going to change the kid's personality necessarily.
Right. They're
at the age where that may be more work to get that part done.
Bill, you talked about all the therapists these kids are seeing every day. So what does the therapy look like? Is it traditional talk therapy?
Quite a bit of it is. Quite a bit of it is focused around their behavior. And, you know, one of the striking characteristics about these kids and about psychopaths, older psychopaths, is that their behavior is very self-defeating. Typically, they end up, you know, in jail or in more trouble or losing out on things that if they had just been a little bit more honest, they could have come out a lot better. Mm. And so we talk to them a lot about the self-defeating nature of their behavior, but even more about when they do have a day where they're challenged or they have a kid who tries to provoke a fight and they don't get into a fight, we want to talk to them about how did that happen, what do they have inside of them that allows them to control their behavior and to understand how other people are thinking and feeling and those kinds of things. Try to pull some of their strengths out so that they can begin to use those in a more adaptive way.
Yeah, I think that's terrific. It's what we call strength-based. Hey, listen, Michael and Sandra, I'd like you to stay tuned because in a couple of minutes we're going to hear some excerpts from my interview I did with Othello's Iago on Saturday. It was a fascinating day. So we've been talking about psychopathy today with Michael Caldwell and Sandra Brown. And earlier in the show, we heard from William Herstein. So I'd like to thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we go today, I've just read that researchers in the UK carried out an academic study looking into Shakespeare's, quote, other life. The research suggests he had an unsavory side and was a ruthless businessman and a tax dodger. Sounds like the inspiration for some of his characters. Oddly enough, I just did a staged event with the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater, during which I held a therapy session for one of Shakespeare's greatest villains, Iago from Othello, and arguably one of the greatest villains in all of literature. In the play, Iago was passed up for a promotion by General Othello. Embittered by the loss, Iago plots to completely destroy Othello. And through masterfully heartless manipulation and deception, spoiler alert here, he succeeds. For the therapy session, I meet with Iago, played by actor Jay Hernandez, well after the curtain closes. In this excerpt, I ask him about his heart. But first, I ask him to recite a soliloquy in which he explains that even though he didn't get the promotion, he will remain loyal to Othello, not out of love or duty, but because he wants to exploit him and dupe him.
Were I the Moor, I would not be Iago, and following him I follow but myself. Heaven is my judge. Not I for love and duty, but seeming so for my peculiar end. For when my outward action doth demonstrate the native act and figure of my heart in compliment extern, 'tis not long after, but I will wear my heart upon my sleeve for daws to peck at. I am not what I am.
Tell me about that heart.
I think it's always best to keep it protected.
From?
The elements.
I want to hear about the daws now. The daws in your life, Iago.
I believe that they're everywhere. And you have to keep yourself protected from anyone who may try to do you, your person, or anyone around you harm. And at the same time, you have to protect yourself. Nobody else is looking out for you at all. Nobody.
Ever?
Ever.
In your life?
No one.
So tell me about that heart you have to protect. You've done a masterful job, by the way, at protecting it your whole life. I think it's been invisible.
my heart, and you will think that what I'm saying may not be true, but then again, you're not looking at me with judging eyes. Mm. My heart is full of love. It is. Everything that I do comes out of some sort of fashion of love.
How do you experience love?
It's something that you feel as an energy that people give off around you, whether it be the love of a warm embrace, the love of kinship, the love of camaraderie, brotherhood. You can feel it. It's palpable.
In your body, where,
oh, yes.
Where that heart is.
It ruminates. Yes.
It's not visible in the play to me. How did you feel about Othello?
He was my brother.
You didn't answer my question.
How did I feel
about
the general? There was a time in my life that I would have rather lost my limbs than let him come to any sort of harm.
Yes, he is smooth talking. To hear more from my therapy session with Iago, staged by the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater, go to whyy.org/voices. Next week on Voices in the Family, what can be done to minimize the risk of divorce? Please comment on today's show by going to whyy.org/voices. You can download this show and other Voices shows there or on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter @VoicesInTheFam, and of course you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer for audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Tell Me More is next on